Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Thoreau, and I'm the president of the Independent Institute. I'm delighted to welcome you to our Independent Policy Forum today. As many of you know, the Independent Institute regularly sponsors programs featuring outstanding experts to address major social and economic issues, both domestically and internationally. We often sponsor these in conjunction with important books that we think deal with such issues, and today is certainly no exception. For those of you who are new to the Institute, you have hopefully found a packet at your seat giving you background on our work. The Institute itself, for those who are new to us, is a nonprofit, non-politicized public policy research institute located in Oakland, California. We produce about 8 or 10 books a year and conduct many conference and media projects based on that. The Institute's program is designed to adhere to the highest standards of independent academic inquiry, and the resulting studies are published as books and the various other programs that we pursue, such as today's forum. Our purpose is a Jeffersonian one in that we're interested in seeking truth regarding the impact of government policies, and not necessarily just to tell people what they might want to hear. In so doing, we will not take the public pronouncements of government officials at face value, nor the conventional wisdom over serious public problems. Hence, we invite your involvement, but be prepared for new and perhaps unusual and perhaps even startling perspectives. We neither seek nor accept government funding. The Institute itself draws its support from a broad range of foundations, businesses, and other organizations and individuals, and we invite you to become a member, tax-deductible member of our program, so that you can participate with the new books and events, including our current forum today, as well as our new journal, The Independent Review, and much more. Our program today is a very special one. And in making this Independent Policy Forum possible today, I want to especially thank the members of our host committee for their kind assistance and their support, a list of which you'll see on the program in your packet. The program today is one that is rather dramatic. Some have said that the 20th century has been, quote, the century of the total state and the total war. Collectivist ideologies of left and right have been used to justify unprecedented state power over any and all aspects of human life in many parts of the world. From welfare to warfare, states have proclaimed their alleged right to roll over the values, civil and economic liberties, and private institutions of free people. The all-powerful police states of fascism and Nazism and communism, with their concentration camps and Orwellian oppression of individual choice, dignity, and dissent, have dominated and decimated the lives of billions. In his best-selling book, The Road to Serfdom, the late Nobel laureate economist F.A. Hayek traced this totalitarianism through the collectivist ideologies rooted in the West, where in the name of the public good, national security, fatherland, proletariat, and social welfare, governments have been exalted by people, both well-intentioned and not, to transgress the peaceful choices of people and the private domains of civil society, and to replace the rule of law by the rule of brute force. Hayek was essentially saying that communism, fascism, theocracy, and other tyrannies are only tyrannies because they require the individual rights to be essentially to be subservient to the power of the state, regardless of whether the state voices support for civil liberties or not. Hayek was critiquing perhaps what could be called all flags, regardless of color, left or right. So long as they are instruments to collectivize and trample civil society into submission for some power elite's purposes. In short, we should not be surprised that when governments are empowered to centrally plan control and otherwise dominate human endeavor, state edicts can only be enforced by subduing the public by official propaganda, backed up by the means of police power. In effect, our society is to be based on mutual cooperation, free exchange, open markets, and choices among free individuals, or are they to be based on the regimentation and militarization enforced by a garrison state? The history of China in this century is largely one of human suffering on an incredible scale, an unprecedented scale. Even former Chinese Communist Party Secretary Zhao Ziyang calculated that about 50 million people have been killed in non-war-related deaths since 1949, 30 million of whom perished during Mao's Great Leap Forward, and another 5 to 10 million perished during the 1966 to 76 Cultural Revolution, so-called. However, although the world largely understands the collectivist horrors of the Nazi concentration camps and the Soviet Gulag, almost no information has been available on the world's largest existing forced labor camp system, the Chinese Logai, now estimated to incarcerate 16 to 20 million people, including over 500,000 political prisoners. In April 1960, Chinese authorities arrested the then 24-year-old Harry Wu. Though never formally charged, during the next 19 years, he was imprisoned in a hellish netherworld of crushing labor, starvation, and torture. Harry Wu survived by realizing he must live on to work for the demise of the Logai's network of 5,000 slave labor camps that, despite recent economic liberalization, remains the Chinese government's most doggedly guarded secret and perhaps its greatest shame. More recently, on June 19, 1995, Harry was again arrested, this time on charges of espionage by Chinese government officials. Triggering worldwide protests, his plight became a cause célèbre and the critical link in Chinese-American relations. Sentenced to 15 years imprisonment, he was finally released only when world opinion became intolerable for Chinese government officials, who at that time desired to host a United Nations conference on women and did not want to face the humiliation. Based on his books, Logai and Bitter Winds, which I strongly encourage each of you to get copies of, they're quite amazing, quite frankly. Based on these two books, Harry Wu has tirelessly worked to reveal to the world the truths behind China's slave labor camp system and its linkage to the political system it serves, a system stripped of individual rights and the rule of law. Harry Wu's experience is the epic and deeply moving story of personal triumph over dehumanization and systematic brutality. His imprisonment, extraordinary acts of courage, and survival bear indelible witness to the power of the human spirit. In our policy forum today, we will address many of these issues. To say that Harry Wu has become something of a bombshell is beyond understatement or overstatement. Some have compared his work to that of American revolutionary Samuel Adams, abolitionist Frederick Douglass, Nobel laureate author Alexander Solzhenitsyn, pacifist Mahatma Gandhi, and civil rights leader Martin Luther King. With the recent military intimidation of the Taiwanese people by mainland China, the presidential election in Taiwan, and next year's occupation of Hong Kong by the government of Beijing, the issues of freedom and self-determination in that part of the world, as well as elsewhere, will simply not go away. They will not go away despite the politics of special interests who might wish otherwise. Harry Wu himself is executive director of the Logai Research Foundation and a research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He's a graduate of Beijing College. He was formerly visiting professor of geology at the University of California at Berkeley. He has repeatedly addressed the United Nations Human Rights Commission and has testified before hearings of numerous Senate and House committees, as well as legislatures in Australia, and in England. Nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, Harry Wu is the recipient of innumerable awards, too long to list. And he's further been the subject of many, many documentaries on television around the world. Before we start the rest of our program, I'd like to share with you some excerpts from two of these documentaries.
If the label says made in China, what it doesn't say is made in China by prisoners in forced labor camps. Prisoners whose only crime may have been speaking out against the system, preferring democracy to Chinese communism. And on many garments and many products, that's the case. That's why Congress wants to attach conditions before they agree to renew China's most favored nation trade status, or MFN as it's called. President Bush supports renewing China's preferential status without conditions and informed Congress that he's obtained a firm, high-level commitment that prison labor products won't be sold to the U.S. Are the Chinese keeping their word? Not from what we saw in China just a few weeks ago. In a remote prison camp called Tongamu in the barren foothills of the Tibetan Plateau, we took these pictures of prisoners marching to work in blue uniforms. Many of these inmates are here for life. In another camp in the capital of Qinghai province, these prisoners are processing sheepskin and making leather goods which, as we discovered, will end up in stores across America and around the world. The videotape was shot by Harry Wu, former Chinese political prisoner now living in California. He agreed at great personal risk, since he's still a Chinese citizen, to go back with a hidden camera to do what no outsider has ever done before, take pictures inside Chinese forced labor camps.
You spent a total of how much time in prison?
19 years.
Yeah. Harry Wu's crime? As a student, he spoke out against the Soviet invasion of Hungary. Not far from Beijing, Wu managed to get us into the Qinghe prison farm, where he spent four of his 19 years as a political prisoner, and where he says he was nearly starved to death. Entrance is strictly forbidden to anyone but labor camp personnel. But on this day, as we drove 15 miles from one end of the camp to the other, no one stopped us. We could never figure out why. Along the way, we could see prisoners at work building a canal with picks and shovels, which is exactly what Harry Wu did when he was in this prison.
If they catch you doing this, what happens to you?
Go back to the camp again.
You could go back to prison.
Of course they won't put me back again.
Why are you doing it?
Because I think the world have to realize there's a camp system in China.
A prison camp system modeled on the now-defunct Soviet Gulag, which experts say is made up of several thousand labor camps and millions of prisoners. Most prisoners are forced to sign confessions before they're even tried, and once convicted, few have a realistic chance to appeal their sentences. Human rights groups say brainwashing and torture are rampant. How many political prisoners are there? Recent secret Chinese documents indicate that approximately 1 in 10 are in prison for political reasons, says China scholar Orville Schell, who was our consultant on this story.
We don't really know how many prisoners there are. Let's take 5 million. It's a totally arbitrary number, and we can't be much more definite, but that means that there's 500,000 political prisoners. That's a lot of political prisoners.
All prisoners, including political prisoners, are supposed to reform themselves by doing forced labor, reform through labor, as the Chinese call it. And this is one of the prison factories where reform through labor takes place, a plant on a busy street in Shanghai that makes hand tools. From the front, it looks like a normal factory. But behind the facade, on a side street, the barbed wire and the guard tower are unmistakable. In Beijing, Teng Zhuguang, who is Vice Minister of Foreign Economic Relations and Trade, the government ministry in charge of China's exports, repeated to us the commitment his government reputedly made to President Bush.
No question but that the policy of the government says that products made through forced labor will not be exported from this country.
No.
Under no conditions.
Under no condition.
Posing as a Chinese-American businessman who wanted to import hand tools, Harry Wu met with officials at the Shanghai Laodong Machinery Factory, the prison factory that makes the tools. Wu asked about purchasing some to sell in the United States and secretly recorded the conversation. Remember, it is illegal for forced labor goods from any country to be sold in the U.S.
We would like to speak quite openly with you because in the U.S., Congress recently made a big deal about the special nature of our kind of enterprises.
What about the special nature of your enterprise?
Our products are never exported directly. We always go through the import-export company system.
As far as I know, the U.S. has a trade law that prevents importation of products made by prison labor.
But we will be exporting indirectly.
But they'll be able to find out. This will give us trouble because the customs will find out.
Not if we don't export directly.
We invited the prison officials to another meeting in a Shanghai hotel room and secretly recorded our conversation. Harry Wu introduced me as the president of the American company interested in importing their hand tools. I told them that the one thing that bothered me was the reliability of their prison workforce.
Given that these people are what you call reformed through labor, we would call forced labor, that they're reliable, and that they turn out a good quality product.
They told me there'd be no problem, that their factory had been in business for 41 years.
You know, I have to be honest with you, Mr. Tong. I have spoken to officials in Shanghai, of the Shanghai Laodong machine plant, which uses forced labor. They said they don't export directly. They do it through export-import companies.
It's not to my knowledge, in the first place. No prison-related manufacturing facilities has been ever given the right to engage in foreign trade. They're not allowed.
I saw it with my own eyes. It's not in some obscure part of the country. It's in the middle of Shanghai.
Mm-hmm.
Prison officials have told me that they want our business. They could export to the United States, and there was a way to get around the problem of the United States Congress by doing it through an export-import company.
To me, it's inconceivable.
I heard.
They're not supposed to.
But they're doing it.
Then they are violating the government policy. If that is true.
But 3 weeks after we interviewed Vice Minister Tong, the Shanghai prison factory was still sending faxes to Harry Wu trying to sell those prison-made goods.
Can you understand that Americans don't want products made by these people under forced labor exported to the United States?
As a matter of policy, the Chinese government never allows the export of what you call forced labor product.
This may be China's official policy, but we had no trouble finding that numerous government-owned Chinese enterprises are violating it with impunity. In the forced labor camp where they process sheepskin and leather, Harry Wu asked the prison manager about importing his forced labor products to the U.S. No problem, the plant boss told him. And then he gave Harry Wu the name and address of the import-export firm in Hong Kong that could handle the transaction. So we went to Hong Kong and met the middlemen, the Windmate Trading Company. Once again, we pretended to be importers. They told us a lot of these prison-made leather goods are finished in Korea and sold in the U.S. So we invited them to a meeting that we secretly videotaped. This time, our sound man, Ned Hall, posed as the company president.
The laborers themselves are prisoners.
Yes.
Have you had experience with this kind of labor in the past? Have you found it to be dependable?
Yeah, they have their own regulation, and also we send our people to keep on checking the quality also.
Yes.
Once we report to them, the quality is not up to standard, the prisoner will have the punishment or beating or some other thing.
Did you think that the government of China is capable of enforcing a policy of no forced labor exports?
Absolutely.
Absolutely? Then how was it that the Volvo company received a letter on behalf of China's labor camp enterprises offering to provide, quote, a large number of criminals as very cheap labor to foreign manufacturers?
How would you represent this letter to Volvo?
As I say, I do not know. It's not to my knowledge. I've never heard of it.
I'll show you the letter. I'd be happy to show you the letter. We hear that you want to build plants in Asia. We would like you to build a plant in China, and we will be able to provide a reliable, cheap workforce of prisoners.
I don't know. This name is not even known to me.
You think this is a mistake?
Either a mistake or the letter itself is in doubt.
Then perhaps you can explain to me the 1989 law book, the Law Yearbook of China, which is published by Beijing's Law Publishing House, said that in 1988 alone, the value of products for export made by forced labor increased by 21%. Now, these are the figures published by your government, by government publication. It's in print. How would you respond to that?
I never know it.
You never know it. Now, your position is what? You're the vice minister
of Milford.
Of Milford, which is in charge of export.
And import.
And import. And you don't know that?
No, it has never happened.
That comes from a government publication.
Government publication can make mistakes.
We pointed out to Vice Minister Tung that numerous government publications brag about the use of forced labor for export. One official prison reform journal says the labor reform enterprises throughout the country have great potential for developing exports and earning foreign exchange.
Minister, it comes from your own government publications.
As I say, even those publications make mistakes.
Vice Minister Tung says he can't understand why China's most favored nation trade status should depend on issues he says have nothing to do with trade.
Including human rights, arms control, forced labor, as we talked about.
So that China's continuing most favored nation trade status should have nothing to do with human rights in this country.
No, not in my view.
Should have nothing to do with forced labor in this country.
No.
It is only about business.
Business is business.
The Hong Kong government is expected to introduce legislation next week that would ban the trade in human organs from China. The Taiwanese government is expected to follow suit shortly. Now, they're responding to pressure from human rights groups who protest that China is using executed prisoners to supply human organs. About 2,000 such operations are performed in China every year, many on foreigners who pay up to £30,000 for a kidney transplant. China says the consent of the prisoner is obtained in advance. You may find some of the pictures in this report by Sue Lloyd Roberts disturbing.
Sentencing to death in China is a public affair. On special days like National Day and the New Year, which are televised, the number can swell to 100 in one day. The crimes of these young people, some only teenagers, range from murder to car theft or mere political dissent. The prisoners are taken immediately to the execution site and killed with efficiency and the minimum of ceremony. But the story doesn't end here. As the prisoners are prepared, an unmarked van leaves the local hospital carrying the doctors and equipment necessary to extract the prisoners' organs immediately after death at the execution site. Young prisoners, those under 25, are the preferred targets for this purpose. The Chinese tell you that it enables the condemned men to pay their debt back to society. In this hospital in central China, I was allowed to film a patient as he was prepared to receive an organ. Chinese doctors now working in the West say that 90% of the organs used in transplants come from executed prisoners, and there's a lucrative trade developing in patients coming to China for this purpose from America, Europe, and nearby Hong Kong. It's believed hundreds of foreigners are coming to China every year for their kidney transplants to hospitals like this in Canton that services the Hong Kong market, and that the number is increasing all the time. What worries human rights organizations is the possible connection between this growing business and the increase in the number of death sentences being handed out in China today. There is no system of voluntary organ donors in China, and patients recovering in the transplant wards tell you that executed prisoners make ideal organ donors.
They told me my kidney came from an executed prisoner because you get them fresh that way. Because from the taking out of the kidney, it is only a few hours to get it transplanted in me.
But at hospital number one in Chengdu, they're delighted with the commercial benefits of the system. They're rebuilding here at the cost of $8 million, money they say that's coming from patients from abroad. There are luxuries here unheard of for locals, like rooms with televisions and ensuite bathrooms, but ideal for patients from Hong Kong, Japan, and America, who pay the hospital around $30,000 per transplant. Posing as potential buyers with the American writer and former Chinese dissident Harry Wu, we inquired at the hospital about arranging an operation for a fictitious sick relation. We were told there'd be no problem, and they were used to foreigners.
Most from America?
America, maybe the majority America, and something for somebody from Hong Kong or something.
We were then referred to Dr. Yang for an initial consultation, a meeting that I filmed secretly.
The quality of our kidneys is better than in America because we can remove the kidney fast and at the appropriate time. Basically, as soon as we know the donor is brain dead, we can get at the kidney with the minimum fuss. And we can guarantee several kidneys in 1 month. The distance between where we remove the kidney and the transplant is short. We can do it all in less than 10 hours. In America, it takes more than 20 hours.
All over the world. Yeah. It was then time to discuss money with Comrade Wu, chief party member and foreign liaison officer at the hospital. Again, we had to film it secretly. No, we don't take credit cards, she said. We prefer cash, preferably dollars. Things are done differently in this country compared with yours. We can do what is impossible from the legal point of view in your country. But she got quite agitated when we asked her outright whether the organs came from prisoners.
I'm not talking about whether it is prisoners or not. In China, we believe that it is much better if not too many people get involved in this kind of thing. My point is that you would be well advised not to get involved in this. It could get complicated.
Most of the information about the execution and transplant program in China comes from outside, from expatriate Chinese like Gao Peiji, former deputy police commander, who's currently seeking political asylum in Britain. He fled China after exposing corruption among his colleagues, and he's familiar with the detail of the executions.
There are 2,300 towns and provincial centers in China, and each has a prison where every year they carry out a number of executions. So at the very least, we are talking about several thousand, maybe even more than 10,000 executions in China a year. In the north, all the executions are carried out by shooting in the head. That way it leaves the organs intact in the rest of the body to be removed for transplant. For the most part, they remove handcuffs and leg irons from the prisoner before tying his hands behind his back with a rope. They also put a rope around his neck to stop him shouting out anti-government slogans before he dies. In the south, they sometimes shoot in the heart. That way they can get at the corneas for transplant. The executioners stab the prisoners in the back with a bayonet to make the body go rigid, to ensure that the marksman can get a good shot.
The Chinese government have admitted that they use the organs of executed prisoners, but they say it happens only in rare instances and only with the consent of the person executed. According to the 1984 laws on the use of dead bodies or organs from condemned criminals, organs can be taken from uncollected dead bodies, or the ones that family members refuse to collect, and from those condemned criminals who themselves or whose families give consent. But Mr. Gao disagrees.
In the 10 years that I worked for the Public Security Bureau, I never saw or heard anything to suggest that death row prisoners were asked for consent before donating organs. Nor was the family asked. In fact, more often than not, the prisoner's family would be held under house arrest by the Public Security Bureau while the execution was taking place. Only by agreeing to pay the authorities for the urn would they be allowed to come and collect the ashes.
In most villages and towns in China today, you'll find execution notices. Human rights organizations claim that the number of death sentences being passed in China today is higher than at any time since the 1950s. Here, a notice with four young people under 25 sentenced to death in towns hundreds of miles from their own homes. They're among the millions of mainly young people who are roaming China looking for work today. It's often these people who turn to crime and who, anonymous and far from home, become death row prisoners and then, unwittingly, organ donors.
We know in Chinese political environment, once one become a criminal, especially a political criminal, most of the family must openly denounce them. No one dares to pick up the body. So it becomes the government properties. At present, there are 70 million people is traveling around in the country looking for a job. And most of them are young, low education peasants. If once they commit the crimes, it's sentenced and executed far away from their native lands, most of the family are not available to pick up their body.
It's the involvement of doctors in China in this operation that appalls the medical profession in the West, and especially reports of organs being removed before execution, that is, vivisection. This is confirmed by a doctor who has since fled China and must remain anonymous. He says he was part of a team that was ordered to take both kidneys from prisoners who were still alive.
I was ordered to take both kidneys from an anesthetized prisoner. Without both kidneys, a person dies within 24 hours. After I had sewn him up, the organs were taken away by helicopter. Of course, kidneys are better fresh, and I can only assume they were for a high-ranking party member.
For decades, the people of China have been the victims of one of the most ruthless penal systems in the world. Today, that system is making them victims of the marketplace, too.
A penal system in service to the state, not justice for the innocent. It gives me great pleasure, and I hope that you will join with me in welcoming Harry Wu.
Thank you, David. Thank you, Maria. Ladies and gentlemen, before I begin, I would like to say a few words of personal thanks. Many people in this room worked very hard last summer to free me. For this, I'm most grateful. Thank you very much. This is my second time regaining my freedom. It took about 66 days, quite short. But the first time it took 19 years. So you can imagine how happy am I. I lost my freedom, I get it back, and I still work on it. Sometimes the people ask me, what are you fighting for? And my answer is quite simple. I say, I hope, I want to see Laogai, L-O-G-I, as a word in every dictionary, in every language in the world. I want to see the Laogai ended. Before 1974, Gulag, G-U-L-A-G, did not appear in any dictionaries. Today, it does. It is a single word which conveys the meaning of Soviet political violence and its labor camp system. Laogai deserve as a word in our dictionaries. Our 20th century has witnessed many catastrophes in human societies, killings during the two world wars, mass destructions by atomic bombs, rapid spread of AIDS, which put together are far drafted by the experiments in bringing out the idea of communism. In politics, economics, culture, morality, human rights, and human life, the costs have been too high to count. In 1848, Marx and Engels' manifesto of the Communist Party began with, quote, a specter, communism is hovering over Europe. 69 years later, in 1917, the specter landed in Russia and took root. Another 32 years passed until in 1949, it blossomed in mainland China. In the middle of the 20th century, communism, youth spread power is one country after another. In certain Western democracy, communist parties were strong enough to come to power. And the saying, quote, the old world shall be replaced by the new world, unquote, was causing a temporary outcry. However, before long, being in the 90s, a series of communist powers began small, like fallen leaves swept away by the wind, simply disappeared from the horizon. All those communist specters had struggled briefly before they were washed down to the big river into the sea. Facing crisis, they all tried to, in 1,001 ways, to survive. Except for Ceausescu, who resorted in a brutal violence, most of them tried to stay in power through political economic reform. Did they succeed, however? The disaster of the Soviet Union, ringleader of the socialist camp, and the communist bloc in the East Europe should be attributed a number of the factors, like the existence of the opposing Western value of democracy, the emergence of such pagans like Solzhenitsyn, Sokolov, Gorbachev, and others. The factor is, of course, the absurdity of the communist system itself, which based on absolute truth, rules through the totalitarian ideology as stubbornly resist everything from without, be it favorable or favorable, justify or unjustify. As much as such reform can only be superficial and partial. More likely, the reforms are forcibly rejected by the regime itself. Politically, economically, the communist system lacks feasibility. As a result, it either dies out or takes its old path. Now, what about China? Such is the problem of the global magnitude in the last years of the 20th century, especially now, when Deng Xiaoping, who came to the power after Mao Zedong's demise and his fame as the chief architect of the reforms, is now but a candle in the wind. What is the future of this biggest communist state in existence? Opinions differed. Everybody is speculating about the reforms said it to be capable of launching the communist power. The present situation in mainland China can be summarized with Lenin's words. Quote, those at the top are no longer able to rule the old way. Those at the bottom do not accept being ruled the old way. Actually, the situation began shortly after the end of the Cultural Revolution, when Hua Guofeng, supposedly trusted by Mao Zedong, appointed by the imperial order, came to the power and, adhering to everything taught and instructed by Chairman Mao, went on carrying out the Maoist line without Mao. It was only natural that he found himself deadlocked. Deng, who replaced Hua, have no choice but to turn back the clock of socialist revolution, to go back from Mao's socialism with complete public ownership as its core towards to the Deng Xiaoping style's primary stage of socialism with Chinese characteristics. In the name of the policy of reforms and open up, he is trying to raise socialism from the dead, but transfusing capitalistic blood into it. A country just like a bird with its own two wings, politics, economic. The bird cannot fly with either of its wings tied up. The Soviet bird is its economic wing tied up, desperately tried its political wing, only crashed. What about the Chinese communist bird? The Chinese communism system is characterized by the totalitarianism, bureaucracy, and public ownership system of the means of production. True, due to the alternations in the economic and society, the last two are showing signs of the slight slackening. Output value of the non-public ownership sector is soaring, and approaching that of the public ownership sector. State-owned enterprises are thinking about how to file for bankruptcy and how to sell themselves to private or foreign businessmen. Transformation to private ownership system is happening very slow, very small. However, in mainland China, land, industrial, mining enterprises, communication, bank system, transportation system, education facility are all placed under the absolute control by the Communist Party. Any economic boom and development are but like farming in the desert today in China. You could reap a bumper harvest with high tech, but it is not natural. Gene transformation can be only be achieved through the transformation of ownership of means of production. how to transform public ownership as a whole into private. These days, counter-revolutionary restoration is advancing. The Chinese bird is still struggling. It could gradually flow upwards if the economic wing, well, fluttering forcefully, unites the political wing. It could also die of exhaustion of the political wings is prevent from joining the economic wing. Without the policy of reforming and open up, we could not have stood up in the test of June 4th, such as Deng Xiaoping's comments of the Tiananmen Square events of 1989. Deng also said, quote, economically, countries and regimes run us develop faster than we do. If we cease developing or develop slowly, people will compare and things will go wrong, unquote. Deng is seeking for ways that allow the communist system to survive. He understands, without saying that, the consequences of introduction capitalism into China are unpredictable. But what could he do in the face of the general trend? With its emergence from the shadow of Tiananmen Square massacre, the dark cloud hanging above China since 1989 has been fading and dispersing without much concern. The highly charged emotional events of June 4th are being replaced by reports of economic boom in China. The West is very much drawn to and interested in the tremendous economic growth in China these days, which is in sharp contrast to the stagnated economic here in the West. It is empire. Supply of cheap labor and potential of its vast market demand are just too tempting to let such an opportunity pass by. Capital and technology are what the West rushed to offer. Today, the Western cash that fuels the tank of the communist vehicles. Despite all the changes in China, over the past decade, two things are still true. China is ruled by the Communist Party, and it is not a nation of laws. China's basic political and economical superstructures remain based on public ownership. The peasants have no land of their own. Financial mechanism is entirely controlled by the government. The vast majority of basic industrial enterprises are state-owned. Capitalism requires respect for individual rights, but it does not exist in China today. Private ownership, as we know it in the West, does not exist on any meaningful scale, and the Communist Party has not come to grip with this issue. Until private ownership is allowed on a wide scale, real and permanent economic boom will not happen. Deng Xiaoping economic reform really have no bearing on the fundamental problem facing China today. The basic issue of the economic system, which is ownership in China, remains unresolved. The economic boom made possible by capitalism makes profit for both the West and China. In spite of huge profits earned by Chinese external trade, ordinary people enjoy only a tiny part. The communist government puts most of the profits into upgrading its weapon system, into internal external political activities, into maintaining political stability for the nation. it creates a communist bourgeois class. The argument that capitalism brings democracy has numerous problems, not the last of which is that there are no historical precedents to point out, to point to. With the advance of singularity, Deng Xiaoping's rule as the glue of the political power is failing. In the Communist Party's 70-year history, internal power struggle have always been vicious. In face of changed political beliefs and the varied demands of local forces due to varied paths of economically development, the next core struggle could quite possibly result in violent surge sweeping and splitting the whole nation in civil war, completely cramming production and social order. All of the factors and many more, such as corruption, the social impact of millions migrants workers, and the continued repression of religious believers and peaceful dissidents, combined to make China a very risk climate in which to do business even without Deng Xiaoping's death. Over the past 40 years, the Communist Party's rule encountered several major crises, in particularly the 1960 to 1962 famine resulted in the death of about 30 to 40 million people. The Cultural Revolution inflicted immeasurable and indescribable sufferings and hardships to all of her own people. Curiously, the communist regime has escaped unhurt from these crises, partly because of the high tolerance level of most Chinese, thanks to the Chinese culture and traditions, and partly because of their trust in the means communism is China's only future. Mao is our great God. The superstructure of the communist regime is heavily damaged, but nevertheless remains stable under this circumstance. Today, a specter is hovering over mainland China, capitalism. Communism is dead, as no longer exists as a belief, which used to be a vital force to its system. To the Chinese in general, and also the majority of the Communist Party members, bubble economic boom achieved in the capitalistic way made the superstructure of the communist regime appear pretty on the outside, but its posts are heavily damaged. Looming in front of her are some huge crises. The core of the human rights question in China today is that there is a fundamental machinery for crushing human beings. We should not only focus on a number of the well-known dissidents. We want to see the crushing machine entered. In China, they call this as Laogai camp, of which we have identified 1,100. And it is also an integral part of the national economy. Its importance is elucidated by such facts that one third of the Chinese tea is produced in Laogai camps. 60% of Chinese rubber vulcanizing chemicals are produced in one single Laogai camp in Shenyang. The first and second chain hoist works in China in the country is receive direct export of authorized Laogai camps in Zhejiang province. One of the largest, earliest exporters of the hand tools is a camp in Shanghai. An unknown but significant amount of Chinese cotton crop is growing by prisoners. And I could go on and on and on. The rich of the Laogai business was recently brought to light again when it was revealed that auto components from the Beijing Laogai are being used at the Beijing Jeep joint venture involving Chrysler. The Laogai system's fundamental policy is forced labor is means, thought reform is basic aim. The Communist Party's economic theory holds that men and women are the most fundamental productive force, except for those who must be exterminated physically out of the political considerations. Human beings must be utilized as a productive force, with submissiveness as the condition. Submissiveness can be achieved through violence, but psychologically and spiritually, submissiveness are the best. The Laogai is not a simple prison system. It is a political tool for maintaining the Communist Party's totalitarian rule. Not only did President Clinton, who had condemned despots from Baghdad to Beijing in 1992, reserve his moral position, but he has also delayed human rights from trade in U.S. policy in 1994. As a matter of fact, the human rights issue as a tool of the U.S.-China policy is being thrown away. We do remember that on May 28, 1993, President Clinton signed an executive order placing human rights condition on the renewal of the most favored nation trading status, MFN, so-called, for China. On September 9, 1993, Assistant Secretary of the State Winston Law said, quote, "The administration has a commitment to human rights and enforcement of the prison labor MOU. China's most favored nation trading status is conditioned on it. It would not be extended if there is no satisfactory implementation of the MOU and overall progress on human rights," unquote. However, the fact is there are a large number of different Laogai products that continually to enter the United States markets. Last year, we found a number of artificial flour, rubber shoes, tea, steel pipes, hand tools, graphite from the Laogai camps and get in the market of the United States. Furthermore, one of the conditions in the President's executive order is, quote, "ensuring human treatment of prisoners, such as by allowing access to prisoners by international humanitarian and human rights organization." But I was told by the Red Cross International senior official in February 1995 at Geneva, they were pessimistic about reaching an agreement with Beijing government to visit Laogai camps in China. The other condition in the President's executive order is, quote, "releasing and providing an acceptable accounting of for Chinese citizens imprisoned or detained for the nonviolent expression of their political and religious beliefs," unquote. The President order, especially the Chinese, must make, quote, "overall significant progress in these areas." At different times, and including during the visit of Secretary of the State, Warner Christopher, some of Chinese most important dissidents were released. Many are being rearrested. Democracy war activists, Wei Jingsun, who had been released in September 1993 after nearly 15 years in Laogai, has been sentenced again under the 14 years. On May 4, 1994, U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee held a hearing on the use of executed prisoners' organs in China. This testimony and BBC News report indicated the practice in China is a little different from those of the Nazis. We must understand the Chinese Communist lies all the time. It lies its own people, it lies to foreign governments. There are small lies and big lies, but they are lies. Once they said the Communist was heaven and Mao was the God. They lie and said there are no political prisoners in China. They lie and said there are no religious freedom. There are religious freedom in China. They lie and said they do not export missiles and nuclear weapons to Pakistan. They lied about me and to me. We must understand that the end of the communist system does not mean the emergence of the democratic society. In China, it is a long, long path leading to an unforeseeable future. Thank you.